You're listening to At Any Rate, JP Morgan's Global Research Podcast, where we take a look at the story behind some of the biggest trends, themes, and industries in the markets today. I'm Alex Rover, head of U.S. interest rate strategy for JP Morgan Securities, and joining me today is Josh Younger, head of interest rate derivative strategy. So Josh, about 3 weeks ago, we wrote about the impact of the coming sunset of the SLR on large bank and their holdings of treasuries and reserves. Now we're revisiting the topic with respect to swap spreads. I guess in the process, you did a deep dive on the nuances of the SLR at both the bank and the holding company level. Tell us all about that.
Sure. Well, thanks, Alex. I think just for a very quick review, the supplementary leverage ratio, SLR, is one of the ways in which regulators have attempted to cap the size of the banking system. So basically, the idea is all of your assets contribute to your leverage exposure, as well as some other low risk but high notional trades like repo and some forms of derivative exposure. All of this contributes to a leverage exposure measure, and capital adequacy with respect to leverage is assessed based on a ratio to that number. So basically, no matter what you're buying, whether or not it's low or high risk, long or short maturity, any number of other features, it all contributes equally to this leverage measure, and therefore banks have to hold a certain amount of capital for a certain size. That ratio is set at 5% at the holding company level and 6% at the bank level. And that difference is important for two reasons. The first is that asset growth, which the carve-outs that you referenced before was meant to avoid leverage becoming binding as the Fed continued to expand its balance sheet and the Treasury embarked on a significant debt financing plan. That asset growth really falls mostly within the banking entity, the insured depository institution, and that's because reserves mechanically stay within the banking system, so that's the bank. And those treasuries were mostly purchased in AFS, available for sale portfolios, as part of the bank investment process, not as part of their market making activities, the dealer operation. So the asset growth that was putting pressure on leverage was happening at the bank level. But when we look at the supplementary leverage ratio buffers, the difference between the actual SLR for a given bank and its minimum, really for a very long time, since the introduction of the disclosure associated with these regulations, the banking entities have operated much closer to their minimums than did the holding company. And so the question is sort of, why is that the case? And what does that tell us about the interaction between these two entities as we head towards a real decision point for how regulators are going to deal with the ongoing asset growth? The Treasury still needs to issue. The Fed is still expanding its balance sheet. A lot of that pressure is falling on the banks. So there are two separate carve-out rules. And so the question is, what is the potential for a shift in their incentive structure as that deadline approaches? And how does specifically the holdco interact with the bank in abiding by these ratios?
So let's get into that topic. How exactly do the rules influence what the holding company is doing and what's going on at the bank level and how the two interact with one another?
Yeah, so what's interesting about this is it's fairly efficient to downstream capital from the holding company to the bank. And that can be done through an equity investment in the subsidiary. There are limits, such as double leverage limits, to how much of this can be done, but it's fairly permissive. It doesn't look like any banks are particularly close, at least maybe with a couple of exceptions to those limits. And so the holding company can, as needed, recapitalize the bank that falls within its organizational structure. So basically the idea is the holding company acts as a very flexible source of capital that can be redistributed across its subsidiaries such that the holding company holds the excess leverage capital for the institution as a whole. And that is simply allocated to support the activities of those underlying subsidiaries. So the bank can and arguably should operate relatively close to its minimums because as needed, it can simply be recapitalized by the holding company, which is why when we look back over the past 3 or 4 years, the holding company buffers were closer to 1.5-2% versus the minimums in SLR, whereas the bank was often less than a percent, very frequently less than 0.5%. It's particularly pronounced for the money center banks. The broker dealers and the custody banks have a somewhat less consistent relationship between their banking subsidiaries and the holding company, although their banks are smaller, so that's not necessarily surprising. But among the money center banks, that's where the vast majority of the asset accumulation has happened. So that's what's particularly affected, and that's where this relationship is very important. It's key because the way the carve-outs were written, at the holding company level, the reserves and treasuries do not count towards total leverage exposure, full stop. That is a Federal Reserve regulation. The Federal Reserve has jurisdiction over holding companies, sole jurisdiction. Whereas at the banking subsidiary level, the insured depository institution, the carve-outs come with stipulations. Basically, you have to opt in. And in exchange for this preferential treatment, there is enhanced regulatory review of distributions. And that may not be particularly attractive to some institutions. In fact, it looks like very few opted into this treatment. And so the question going forward is, you know, will those banking subsidiary rules remain in their current form? Will they be extended? And there is a very practical matter of the fact that there are three relevant regulators at the banking subsidiary level, whereas there's just one at the holding company level. So the time until the expiry of these regulations creates potentially just a logistical issue in terms of reaching a consensus among those three regulators, the Fed, the FDIC, and the OCC, whereas it's much more straightforward to extend the holding company regulations. The scenario that we're sort of trying to think about implicitly is one in which there is some form of extension at the holding company level, but either the stipulations associated with carve-outs at the banking subsidiary level remain relatively unappealing, or those rules are not extended at all. And so the question is, how much can the holding company support the bank in the continued inflation of its balance sheet due primarily to monetary policy decisions by the Federal Reserve? And basically what we're finding is that there's quite a bit of capacity there, especially if the carve-outs are extended at the holding company level.
So given that, you know, we think there is capacity, you know, if this is extended at the holding company level, I guess, you know, the next question is really, what's the outlook for the swaps market near term and I guess longer term, depending on the different sunset scenarios?
Yeah, so the key to excess leverage capital is it allows a banking entity and a holding company and the banking system in general to make decisions that are motivated more by the economics of their risk management than by these relatively hard and fast leverage constraints. And so in a scenario where either reserves or reserves and treasuries are extended at the holding company level, that excess leverage capital can be allocated to the bank as needed. And what that does is it allows them to focus on really what they do for a living, which is manage interest rate risk and monetize credit spreads and in the process of liquidity transformation. So the question then becomes, if there's excess leverage capital to deploy, where does it get deployed and why would it get deployed there? And if for most banks, there is still a need to add duration. And in doing so, it's particularly appealing to add securities that either carry or come with a headline spread versus Fed funds expectations that are significantly positive, meaning you expect or can lock in a positive spread with respect to forward expectations of the interest you would earn on your reserves, where you simply leave them as cash. And so what this allows for is the continued accumulation of positive Treasury OIS spread assets, using that as a relative value measure. And that's at this point primarily 7 to 10 year treasuries, and to do so using that as a trigger, meaning, you know, considering relative value arguments, and that has implications for the pricing of swap spreads, because even if swaps are not part of this equation directly, the relative pricing of treasuries versus swaps, the swap spread, will be informed by this kind of activity simply because of its scale. I mean, banks are very large; they have a very large duration gap still to make up. The rise in yields has not alleviated most of it. And so in seeking out sources of duration and ways to deploy deposit inflows at a positive spread to what they would earn on simply holding their reserves at the Fed, we think they'll be increasingly drawn to that 7 to 10 year point of the Treasury curve. That doesn't mean that spreads can widen indefinitely. There is a limit. And frankly, at about 10 basis points over OIS, it becomes a somewhat less attractive trade. But the key is that they are empowered to police that relationship. And that makes for relatively range-bound spreads, which is a good context in which to do carry trades. So owning those 7-year spreads on asset swap slides and carries well should be well contained by bank buying activity. And that sector is kind of where we'd expect most of the impact to lie.
Thanks, Josh, for that look into the dynamics of this rule and how it interplays with the markets. Clients can find out more about this by reading our note, How Important Are Bank-Level SLR Carve-Outs to Swap Spreads, published on Morgan Markets on February 4th, 2021. Stay tuned for more episodes of At Any Rate, JP Morgan's Global Research Podcast Series. This communication is provided for information purposes only. Please read JP Morgan research reports related to its contents for more information, including important disclosures. Copyright 2021 JP Morgan Chase & Company, all rights reserved. This episode was recorded on February 5th, 2021.